welcome to another episode of the Monday Mile podcast. Today, we're in Henley-on-Thames, alongside the River Thames. And that's because I'm about to link up with a lady who knows these waters very well. Her story is far from the typical Paralympic fairy tale. She's a Paralympic rowing gold medalist and a cancer survivor. Her journey hasn't gone to plan as such. At 29, a cancer diagnosis led to her being an advocate for raising awareness and early detection. That diagnosis didn't hold her back, and in 2022, she competed in the Rowing World Cup in Belgrade, Serbia, winning gold just 4 days after her diagnosis, and then went on to win the 2022 European Championships in Munich whilst on chemo. Erin Kennedy. You are superhuman.
Or just a little bit nuts, I don't know.
Welcome to the Monday Mile podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be here.
Thank you for welcoming me to your home club. We've literally just walked past it.
Yeah. Yeah, Leander Clubs is an amazing club. It was really convenient, basically, because it was my local club when I left uni. But it's like the most successful rowing club. Wow, it's the most successful sports club in terms of kind of Olympic medals of any sport in any club in the world. So it's got something like, and I'm going to get this wrong and I'm going to get in trouble for it now, over 140 Olympic medals and Paralympic medals.
Yeah. Well, that's just extremely convenient. Yeah. And you already hold the title of one of those.
Yes. Yeah.
You're just back from Belgrade and Paris Paralympics is quite literally around the corner.
Oh, I know.
How's the form?
It's really good. It's really good. I got back from the European Championships this morning. Yeah, we won, which was amazing. It was like the kickoff for the season for Paris. So it's really exciting. We've got a brand new combination, which is like exciting, but quite scary as well. Because you're like, well, a bit untested. What's it going to be like?
Unpack that for me.
Okay, so I'm a coxswain.
Yeah.
So I am the person in the boat that's basically delivering all the communication. So I'm getting data coming in, which I'm then needing to deliver back out. So that's like boat speed, technical changes, where we are in the race. It's race desk engineer vibes, Formula One.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm getting this Formula One kind of vibe going on.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm doing that sort of live, obviously. And then we've basically got kind of the element of like the kind of technical strategist, coach, and there's an element of like motivation and stuff as well of getting to know my athletes really, really well, so I can really tap into like what makes them tick. So then at that tough point, I can be like, okay, let's go. Like I can make you move. And I row four, so I've got four athletes, two boys, two girls.
So in total, five on board,
including me. But they're putting down the watts, and I'm using my brain. It's like Beauty and the Beast.
That's a crazy contrast because everybody's role is extremely different in that boat. And as an onlooker of rowing, I would just look out, see some rowers on the water, and my initial thought process is, oh, they're all rowing, they're all doing the same thing, and they're going really quick, and it looks extremely painful. But it's actually far from that.
Yeah, everyone's got a really unique role within the boat. And obviously, coxing at the Paralympics, everyone also has, you know, their own impairments, their own sort of reasons for classifying and being there. And the boat I cox is called the PR3 mixed cox 4. It's a bit wordy, but basically they row a normal boat with no major adaptations. They use leg, trunk and arms. And actually, to be honest, walking along, you probably wouldn't necessarily notice a very obvious disability with most of them. A lot of it's kind of, whether it's ankle fusion or one of the girls was in a car accident when she was younger. Basically kind of, it's my job though to kind of cater for those kind of small impairments and basically just make us row the boat fast. The best thing about para sport for me is it's a great leveler. Like we all just come in, you've all got kind of different stories, different journeys, different impairments. Some you were born with, some you know, have picked up along the way. But actually when we're all in a boat, we're all just trying to make a boat go fast and we're as good as the next person.
That's incredible. When it comes to your specific role on the boat, I can imagine communication with those athletes and that relationship is incredibly important because there's a lot of trust there as well.
Yeah, yeah, totally. It's entirely about communication. Like that's the main thing that I do. I do steer the boat, but thankfully at this point, a little bit like driving a car, you're not I almost don't even think about steering anymore.
Yeah.
If the steering broke, I really would be thinking about it. But like, it's all about what I'm doing. So I've got a microphone, which actually goes through to speakers in the boat. So that's how I'm communicating with them. And they hear my voice a lot. Like, you know, training for rowing is not for the faint-hearted. We train 6 days a week, kind of 49 weeks a year. It's silly. All weather conditions apart from lightning. Because we're in a very conductive boat out on the water. But rain, wind, as we experienced at the Euros yesterday, we've basically got to battle through all the elements. And for me, being able to communicate effectively with all of them as a unit and individually, yeah, on and off the water is the most important thing a cox can be.
Is that something that you've learned, or would you say you've always had that skill set, that
both,
ability?
A bit of both, I think. Like, I'm a big people person. It's like the ongoing bane of my husband's life, that like I'm topped up by spending time with others, and he's like, please let us just sit down, just us two. And I'm like, okay, but anyway, tomorrow we've got this and today we've got this. And like, literally, well, got back from the Euros, we left the equivalent time of like 5 a.m. UK time. I'm here doing this with you. I'm going to see some friends for dinner. Like, I just
bam bam bam.
Yeah, Erin, I love it.
Erin's rhyming the schedule.
Yeah, I love it. And I think like the challenge that a cox has is you are sort of taking on different roles. So, you know what it's like when you're away and you're competing, your teammates are your family. You know, there are times when I see my teammates in a month far more than I see my family and my husband. But you're also in this leadership position.
Yeah.
So how do you switch from friend to cox? Especially when you're in training camp, we're away for 2-3 weeks at a time. How do you kind of make that jump? If they've had a training session which wasn't great and I'm like needing to pick them up or hold people accountable, how do you switch that off when you go into breakfast?
How do you do that? What is the secret to managing that different energy that you're sharing with those people?
I would say almost like taking on sort of two personas. You've got kind of the way I would talk to them around the boats and the boat bay or in the boat is in a way that I would never talk to them, you know, sat around a table. Like, in a way, I'd be like, right, get the blades out, let's go. You know,
yeah,
if they're chatting. I'm not like, you know, pass me the salt.
Like, so there's a very different switch in your communication and you're
so
aware of it.
Oh yeah, totally. And it's also like, you can't hold a grudge. Like, you can't, you really can't take anything with you. So if you've had a bad session or a good session or whatever it is, like it's leaving rowing at the door. And then when you go into the changing rooms, like switching it up and being their friend again and being a different person.
Has there ever been a moment where you've caught yourself out and you have overstepped the line and you've taken it to the salt and pepper shaker? When you're all sat around at a team dinner and the vibe's meant to be good? Because it's
probably
quite hard to,
it is hard,
distinguish the two.
Yeah, it's normally, so we've got a real thing rowing, like when our squad, we call like day 9 of camp. When everyone's, my coaches would gently say overextended, but everyone's just bloody knackered. You've been living with these people and someone does something and it's really grinding your gears, and it's probably just like the way that they cut up something in the morning on their plate and you're like, oh, I hate when you do that. And like, and it's at those points when you're really extended. And I think like I've definitely kind of got it wrong at times when I've been too demanding of someone or tried to kind of carry the session and continue a debrief in a time which is like someone's downtime. And it's just learning those boundaries, to be honest. And actually sometimes it's enforcing those boundaries on other people and being like, look, I'm here as your mate, I'm not here as your cox. Like, we need to separate this out because I need the space as well. And it's about learning those things. And I think
would you quite literally explain that? Because let's put it into day-to-day situation. Having a business, whether it be with friends or with family, I have a situation where I'm like, okay, right, we've got a work chat, even on WhatsApp. And anything else, you just don't want it to affect your day-to-day life, because otherwise you can be consumed totally and wholly by that way of speaking to each other. And I think it is different and it does need to be separated. So would you formally vocalize, this is work chat, and then now, you know what, guys, we're going to switch off and we're going to be us?
Yeah, totally. And I think, I don't know, like, I think definitely when it comes to high performance sport, one of the reasons I love high performance is you can just be straight. Like, there's no corporate chat in high performance sport. You don't have time. People don't like beating around the bush, like, and they'll accept, you know, criticism, feedback in a way that's so much more open and direct. And I'm a big fan of that. And I will 100% be like, and that's enough. You know, we're not going to talk about this anymore. We've got plenty of time to do it. And I think one of the most difficult things for me is around selection. The boats aren't set. As I said, we had a new person in this year. It's great that we've got upper pressure, people pushing to be in, you know, like a boat. My crew has obviously had loads of different formations. I've been in it since 2018, but it's been unbeaten now for 14 years internationally, wow. Like never beaten. And that's taken so many impressive individual athletes, and they've all gone through a selection process. They've all got into the boat, and it's making sure that you don't bring like selection into your personal life or whatever, because you've got to switch off.
Does that create a rivalry and dispute in between the individual team members, and then you as a sort of chief communicator have mm-hmm. to sort of bring it all back together? Are you a part of that as well?
Yeah, huge part of it. And it's really tough. It's the hardest part of my year, because there's times when I'm under selection, so I'm then competing with another cox as well, who's, you know, trying to bring their best to the squad, and the expectation then on me is that I'm doing what I would expect the athletes to do, which is be respectful and get the job done. And we're all working towards a project. It becomes quite like project focused. Like we're trying to make the fastest boat. What makes the fastest boat? Who makes the fastest boat? And all these different things. And then eventually when you get to like now, where we've got kind of a crew that's kind of a unit and working together, it comes a lot more like the project is still obviously Paris, but it's a little bit more like, right, how do we build this crew dynamic? How do we get us all working together? What makes you tick? What makes me tick? And it's fun.
That's such a nice way of looking at it, as a project.
Yeah.
And it's a project as a team to make this object fly.
Yeah.
Water. Now take me to Tokyo 2020, uh-huh. Your first Olympics as a cox, but you are not actually a Paralympic athlete. Explain how that works as a cox, how you can swap between the two.
Yeah, so I don't have a disability. So I actually first joined the Gibraltar team as a cox for the Olympic program. And I was going under selection with someone who's a really good friend of mine, Matilda. And ultimately, long story short, in that first season, I didn't get selected for the ultimate world championships, the Olympic seat. And I was devastated. I was absolutely gutted. And I was like, right, what am I going to do? Like the big challenge, if you haven't figured out already, is coxing is so personal. There's real tangible objective things in terms of boat management, how do you operate as an individual, your leadership style, but it's also so personal. Like how do you communicate as an individual? What's your style? How do you operate? And so to get, you know, not selected is tough. And then I was like, what am I going to do? So I thought, okay, like what are my options? And then I kind of got contacted by the Paralympic coach, and we all train in the same training center, literally about 10 minutes from here. And he was like, have you ever considered trialing for us? And at the time they had a great cox. As I said, you know, they've been unbeaten for how many years. And I was like, well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Like, do you need a new cox? And they have a great mentality there. Like, we always need upper pressure. Like, if you think you can, give it a go. And I joined them in 2017, 2018. So coxes can basically jump between the crews, which is really cool. And actually, after going to Tokyo, you know, there was a question in my mind, do I jump into an eight? It's a different boat. It's a new challenge. And I was actually like, do you know what? I'm not that interested in trialing for the Olympics. I'm loving this Paralympic team. It's a much smaller unit. You get to know each other much better. It tests me more. Like the boats themselves need that. I mean, you will have known it with your equipment. I wouldn't have a flipping clue. I could have a look at your equipment and go, well, that's the same as that. And you'd be like, oh, no, actually, this is really good for this, and this is really good for this, and I can tweak this because the conditions look like this and all that. You can do exactly the same in rowing. Every boat, oh, man, I don't even know what the facts are. There's tens and 20, you know, different per seat, different ways of setting up a boat in terms of loading, gearing, height, angles, everything. It's very technical, and I do loads of that. So
it sounds very specific.
Super specific. And then because we've got these impairments to work around, and we've got two boys and two girls, I'm a lot more of an engineer than I ever thought I would be, but it's a great skill to have. And actually being part of the Paralympics sort of really tests me in that way, and I really love it. And to be honest, I'm just surrounded by people that, I hate that, like, you know, inspiration, but like, I am inspired by them. They're amazing individuals who just have made something that's happened to them into something amazing, and you just think, fair play.
Respect, so much respect. Now, you speak about being tested. Mm-hmm. At the age of 29, you were physically put through the ultimate test. Yeah. And you are here today walking proud And you're here today walking proudly as a breast cancer survivor. Mm-hmm. Take me back to 2022 and unpack that story.
Yeah, we're talking about Tokyo. We had a great time. We won
so
gold.
We've got the highest of highs that any athlete can go through.
Yeah.
At your first Paralympic outing, you come back with the gold.
Yeah. Yeah, it was amazing. Like, and even with COVID and post-COVID, we still got to do all these incredible things. Like, went to the palace and we, you know, I've got an MBE and it was amazing. And then, yeah, I basically got back and I was like, yeah, definitely going for Paris. Super excited for it. I was on training camp in May 22 and I was just in the shower and I found a lump that was kind of not normal. So it was just sort of like here. It was relatively obvious because it was sort of just like on my rib cage, but it was one of those things, like if anyone's had anything medical happen to them, when you notice it, it feels like the most obvious thing in the world. Like, how haven't I seen this before? I was pretty regular at checking myself and I knew this sort of wasn't normal. So I arranged to get it checked when I got back and I had 10 days between this training camp and the first World Cup of the season. And I basically, got diagnosed. I actually got diagnosed the day I was supposed to fly to this World Cup, but I chatted to my coach and said, can I fly out a day late? I've got this appointment I need to go to. And I actually chatted to my crew about it saying, look, I've got this appointment. Do you mind if I fly out a day late? Because it's a team sport. Like if they'd have said no, then I probably would have had to send a sub. But they were like, no, we trust you. And one of my teammates, Ollie, said, well, what if it's bad news? And I was like, well, I'm still going to come. Like, what else am I going to do?
Yeah.
Like sit at home and be sad. And I think weirdly then I'd already start processing it, but equally you just think, oh, it won't happen to me. It will never happen to me. I'm fit and healthy. But yeah, I was diagnosed with breast cancer and I was kind of, we're a world turned upside down moment, really.
When you had that meeting and you received that news, how did you react? Because that's a fear that so many people can relate to or have been through. What were your initial thoughts in that moment?
It felt like an out-of-body experience. It was very odd. I almost didn't have the you've got cancer bombshell because when I walked into the room, my husband was with me and he didn't notice. There was a nurse sat with the doctor and I just went, oh no, you're here for like my mental health. Like you're here to help me. And I was like, why are you here? I've had an appointment like this before when it was absolutely fine. And now you're here. And so almost, it was a good thing. It sort of softened the blow. My husband, bless him, had not caught the nurse. And then he had that, you know, Erin's got cancer moment. I genuinely, one of my first thoughts were, well, what about rowing? Like, what about my career? Which is a funny one, really, because obviously you'd expect to be thinking about, oh, you know, am I going to die? Like, what does this mean? But it doesn't feel real at that point. So you're just thinking about, like, the immediate.
Was that a positive distraction?
Yeah.
Would you say?
Yeah, totally. Like, I am a inherently very positive person. Very quickly, I was like, do you know what? This isn't going to define me. I'm not going to let this define me.
That is so strong in that instantaneous moment to have those thoughts. So did you go out?
I did.
To the competition?
Yeah. I had this appointment and, you know, your initial thing is, okay, well, maybe I won't have to have chemo because, you know, some people don't. And then literally his next words were, and you'll be having chemo. I was like, okay, right. Right, okay, I need to deal with this. And I left and I called my mum and dad. My husband Sam called his mum and dad. I called my team doctor, I called my chief coach, and they were like, you sure you're still okay to come out? Is this the right thing? And I was like, yep, 100%. And then I went home. My parents and Sam's parents came over for a Chinese. not my normal pre-race meal. Needs must. And I basically was like, right, let's go. It was exactly what I needed to do. I think when these things happen, you can think how you might respond to things, and also you can maybe tell people what you might want once you've made your mind up. But actually I just did it, and I think for me it really just set the tone for how I was going to approach it. There was no one at that point could question whether I would be able to do anything or anything, and everyone went okay. And if I'm honest, I think it's a huge lesson in life. What you do holds a mirror up to other people and they reflect it back at you. Like if you are, this is what I'm going to do, this is how I'm going to approach this, this is the positivity and the way that I'm going to, you know, get out there. People will reflect that back at you and they'll support you in it. If I'd have just gone, that's it, that's the end of my life as I know it, I'm just going to stop all my things, I'm going to stay in, I'm not going to see people, people would wrap me in cotton wool and they would treat me like a patient before I'd even started treatment. So I was just like, nah, see you later.
Wow, Erin, that is so bold and so strong and so inspirational. Because if you were to be wrapped in cotton wool instantaneously, mm-hmm. that essentially almost takes away an element of your freedom and your passion.
Yeah.
And to fight anything, we need passion.
Oh, totally. And I just think the biggest thing that you can kind of do wrong for someone who's going through a diagnosis, to be honest, it doesn't need to be cancer. It's turning them into something else and changing like their identity. And identity is huge. Like, you'll know from anyone who's not been well, you know, they've gone, I just want to be normal. I don't want to, every time I pick up the phone, everyone want to know the ins and outs of your diagnosis and what's going on with you here, there and everywhere. Like, you just want to chat about Love Island and like whatever's going on in the news and that person who's just gone for a coffee with and all those sorts of things. Like, you don't want, like, because you haven't changed. I think that's the really weird thing about cancer. From the moment I walked into that room, someone said, you're really poorly, and I was like, but I'm not though. Like, I'm fine. Like, I am fit and healthy, really strong, but fundamentally I wasn't well. And that's what's kind of really disconcerting. And then cancer's weird because in an ideal world, the cancer never makes you ill. The treatment will make you ill, but the cancer won't. And thankfully that was the position that, you know, I found myself in. I basically had 5 months of chemotherapy, 15 rounds, which was pretty, it's the most I've ever heard anyone having chemo with breast cancer.
In that process, you were obviously significantly ill from the treatment. You did manage to train through a huge part of it.
Yeah.
But you also lost your hair.
Yes.
In that process. Now, a lot of people would see that change.
Mm-hmm.
And that can make people react differently.
Yeah.
How did you deal with other people's reactions when they saw you with no hair? They saw Erin as someone who was sick.
Yeah. I think you're bang on. Like, everyone thinks about the hair, because if you see someone who is kind of bald, especially a woman, especially if they're young, you know, either that they're unfortunately they're going for chemotherapy, or, you know, they're suffering from alopecia, but like the statistically is they're probably having chemo and they're probably not very well, and people treat you differently, and it used to wind me up so much because it was like, for me, I tried to look at it as, well, this shows the cancer, that the chemo is working. Because essentially the way chemotherapy works is it attacks cells that duplicate quickly, which is your hair, your nails, your skin. If my hair was falling out, it meant that the chemo was working. And so I was just like, right, this is what it is. Like, I used to have hair very similar to yours, actually, long blonde hair, and I cut it all off into a bob. And then, yeah, eventually just started falling out.
In that moment of losing your hair,
mm-hmm.
and people looking at you maybe differently, did you utilise it as an inner strength, knowing that the chemotherapy was working?
Yeah, yeah. And I talked about it, to be honest. Like, a lot of it I talked about. So when I initially got diagnosed, I went out to this World Cup, and not many people knew. My immediate team knew, obviously, the para athletes, but we all compete as para and Olympic all in the same events. None of the Olympic squad knew. I kept it quite tight initially, partly because I just didn't know anything. And I think when you're waiting on medical results or anything, when you don't know, then people ask you questions, it can kind of cause concern, because you're like, I don't know, should I know this? Or like,
yeah.
I was like, I just need to wait until I know stuff before I talk about it. And as I, you know, started to get a handle on, okay, what was going to happen, what happened to me, and what my timelines might look like, I kind of thought, okay, I'm sort of ready to talk about this now. And it was kind of odd, because it almost felt like I was being like secretive, and it was something to be like ashamed of by not sharing it. Like, it's hard to explain, but the other side of it was also like, I wanted to talk about it because I knew at some point I'd have to take a step back from the sport, and I didn't want anyone thinking I was retiring. I didn't want anyone thinking they could come in and get my seat. So I was like, it's hiatus. It's not a departure. And so I decided to, it was around a month after I won the World Cup, 4 days after chemo, I was like, okay, I won that World Cup, and I thought, okay, when I go public,
yeah,
I'm going to tell them about it. I'm going to tell them that you can still do amazing things while you're ill. And if you think, oh yeah, she might not be back, I'll be like, wait till you hear this.
Wait till you watch me. Would you say it's given you a different level of resilience?
Oh yeah. When I went out to that World Cup, I was 99% sure I could do my job and do it well. Because ultimately, like I said, it's a team sport. And it's selfish of me to put myself in a position if I'm not going to do the job well. That's not okay. Like, I can't compromise my team for me wanting to do it. And so I was like, I need to be as good as I ever was, even with all of this going on in my head, in order to do my team justice. But there was 1% of me where I was like, what if I can't do it though? What if I cry, like, in the boat or whatever? And, you know, I could do it. And then I was like, what if I could do this? I could do anything.
Where did that doubt come from in that moment? Was it the pressure of turning up for everyone else?
Yeah, it was definitely around doing it for other people, because ultimately, the weird thing about cancer is when you get a diagnosis, all of a sudden, things are happening to you. You get put on this train, and the train is moving, whether you like it or not, towards chemotherapy. I had to have fertility preservation. I had a double mastectomy. Like, all these things are going to happen. I think, you know, you can't control what's happening to you, but control how you respond to it. And so I was like, right, let's go. And I think that doubt was sort of like, what if it makes me so ill that I don't feel like myself anymore? What if I can't do the things I love? And then almost going out and racing that weekend was like, oh no, okay, I can still do this. And I am still me. I haven't sort of changed. And
so it was the only thing you could control in that situation.
It was how I responded to it.
Can't control your body, you can control your mind.
Totally.
You literally just hit me with the bomb of three things. Chemotherapy.
Yeah.
Double mastectomy.
Yeah.
Fertility preservation. Now, all of those aren't normal things, and you sort of just brushed it under the carpet very casually in our chat, because you are strong, you are confident, and you are bold. But that's a huge undertaking for any male or female to still have a career trucking along on the side. How did you manage the chemotherapy, and how did you apply yourself still to training and work around those blocks of treatment?
The first thing that happened was actually the fertility preservation. So chemotherapy can really significantly impact your fertility. Really varies on the type of chemotherapy you're having, how long you're having it for, all those sorts of things. But I was basically having some big old chemo for a really long time. So the chances of it impacting my fertility was really high. So we had a really, really tight window of time to basically kind of have egg collections. And thankfully, you know, my husband and I have been together now like 14 and a half years, but it was, you know, a couple of years fewer when I was diagnosed, but we were in a position to have embryos kind of created and frozen. And literally I was diagnosed, basically got into the fertility preservation. I did that for 13 days, like straight. And then the day after my egg collection, I started chemo. So there was no time to even process, to be honest. You just had to get on with it. And then the chemotherapy was probably the beginning is the hardest, not physically on your body, but just not knowing how it's going to hit you. You hear all these horror stories, and I hate watching TV dramas when someone's got cancer and you're just like, because it's always the worst, obviously, and it's always a narrative, and it looks a certain way. And the reality is, it hits people so differently in so many different ways. And I just thought, well, I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing while I can, prioritize the things that bring me joy, cut down on the things I don't. Like, I got a cleaner. I was like, I'm not wasting any precious energy on cleaning my house. And I really, really relied on a support network as well. I go to church in Henley, and for every single chemo, they provided me a meal. Well, me and Sam, I wasn't eating a lot, to be fair, but they provided me a meal the day I had chemo and the 2 days after. And bear in mind, I got to a point where I was having chemo every week. So almost half of the week, my dinner was cooked for me by someone else.
So it's all the little small things that contribute, that can make such a difference.
Huge. And I genuinely just credit being able to keep going into the training centre. Obviously, as you can imagine, my training dropped quite significantly as I got deeper into chemotherapy. But I was able to compete at the European Championships whilst on chemo. The blessing of the Cox is I'm not pulling big ergos. My physical presence in the boat is more about my brain and my head and how I'm processing and managing it. And so, yeah, I competed at the European Champs on chemo. And I think that I mean, I can't ever, I mean, I'm building up to Paris, but I can't see it being better than your race right now, because that European Championships was the most amazing experience I've ever had. Like, I was on chemo. I just shouldn't have been there, you know, like, I shouldn't have been able to do it, but
with all the factors,
so many things against me, like, you just wouldn't believe it. And to have my team back me and go, yeah, do you know what? She can do this while she's on chemo. She'll be all right and we trust her.
What would you say to someone right now that may have just received the most horrendous news and they're about to go through the treatment cycle of chemotherapy? What would be your one bit of advice?
I would say, don't lose your identity. Like, you are still you. Whatever they're putting in your body, whatever, you know, you're kind of gonna experience in terms of side effects and all those sorts of things, you are still what makes you you. Just have faith that it's a blip. I kind of took this from my mother-in-law, actually, and she's had breast cancer twice since I've been with Sam. And someone said to her before she started chemotherapy, and they were like, it's just a blip. I think perspective is huge. I was saying, you know, I didn't get that Olympic seat, what, 2016-17. Look where I am now, like, with the Paralympic squad, having the most amazing time. When I had that diagnosis, you just can't see the wood through the trees. And then here we are now, you know, 2 years later, I've just won the European champs. I'm looking forward to Paris in a 3-year cycle as well, where I'm like, for goodness sake, of course I get cancer in a 3-year cycle when I've just got so little time to actually get it right. I just think for anyone who's going to go through it, that mirror thing is huge. Dictate to others how you want to be treated, because things will happen to you, but you can choose how you respond to it. And I think your mindset is the most important thing, and I think that's what sport taught me, and I really took it into kind of that cancer experience.
Erin, that is so strong. And now, to flip the switch, what would you say to someone who is seeing a loved one go through that experience, having been there yourself?
Yeah, I mean, my husband Sam literally is the kind of unsung hero in all of this, because he did it all. He was every sort of role. He was like the gatekeeper, you know, if he thought I was getting too overwhelmed and just being like, just give her a bit of space. He was cleaner, chef, driver. Like, he came to every appointment and he was amazing. And I think it's important to make sure that the partner is considered in it. And it's actually more, if you've got that diagnosis and you're looking at your partner thinking, what can I do, is where can you give them some time back? And it's not necessarily from you, because sometimes you don't have the energy for it. So I set up like a curry group. I basically hijacked his phone and got all his mates' numbers, created a massive WhatsApp group. And I was like, on the first Thursday of every month, you guys are going to go for a curry, because you need to take my husband out and give him a nice time.
Ah, that's so lovely.
And I left the group because I was like, I don't want to see the gifts that are going on in this group now. Like, don't want those notifications. And it's that sort of thing. And like, I pushed him to go skiing with his brother, which, you know, normally you don't have to push anyone to go on a skiing holiday, but it was right towards the end of my treatment. And I was like, you need a break. Like,
you need your time. Because, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
So I think, I guess a lesson in that is recognizing the importance of your partner having their own space.
Totally.
To go and be them, so they can come back and give you the energy that you need.
Yeah, and I just think it's a little bit like, I've got a lot of friends who have babies recently, and it's remembering the mother and not just looking at the baby. It's a little bit like that. And so if you've got friends who, there's a couple, they're going through it, make sure you check in with the partner as well as the person who's going through something, because, you know, they're all going through it together.
Erin, you've without a doubt won that fight. Paris is ahead. Has it given you a newfound perspective of what life on the water now looks like?
It's just such a joy, to be honest. Like, I've always loved my sport. It's a nice sunny day. It's a little bit windy, but, you know, we're down here, the sun's out. And the best thing about rowing for me is, one, it's the ultimate team sport. Everyone is just working for each other. People are literally ripping this handle through for that person in front, that person behind. It's a really honest sport, I think. But also, you can't think about anything else while you're on the water. There's no notifications, there's no phones, there's no distractions. It's an hour, 90 minutes of just like pure focus. And that's just what's such a joy. And yeah, I'm so excited for Paris. It's going to mean so much more than anything I've ever done before, because it's sort of, yeah, it's not the cycle I planned, but it could be pretty amazing. I've got all my oncology team are coming out to the games as a little thank you, and I think they're kind of the unsung heroes in a lot of these. A lot of these stories. Yeah, I'm a bit obsessed with my oncologist. She's pretty amazing. And I was
Paris. What's her name? Let's give her a shout out.
So I've got two. It's Dr. Patterson, Felicity Patterson, the Royal Surrey. And then Tracy Irvine, who's my surgeon at the Royal Surrey as well. I was treated at this young adults unit as well, which was just full of amazing people. The nurses were just incredible. And it's one of the only young adult centres in the whole of the country that goes up to the age of 30. And it's something I feel really passionate about, because I just think the way that we're living our lives as young people has changed fundamentally in the last 20 years. You don't stop being a young adult when you get to 24. If you get cancer at 25, in most places, you're just in the adults ward. Whereas I got to go to the young adults unit, which is just, it was a game changer. It's like basically being in the BA first class lounge when you're at Heathrow. Like, you're all getting on the same flight, but you just have a much better time. Like, you get all the love, all the care. Oh, they're just, it was amazing.
I've not been in the first class lounge.
Oh, we need to get that sorted if you're listening.
Oh, Erin, you just have the most beautifully positive and uplifting soul. For anyone listening to this that's having a tough time, is there one life motto that you live by now that you can share with our listeners?
Yeah, I would say choose your mood. It's something I practice every day. You can choose how you feel. The mind is the most amazing thing. And that doesn't mean you can't choose madness or grief or sadness or frustration, but you can all then, you know, try and choose to find the positives and find the beautiful things in it. We were laughing, you know, before, like, I never used to run, but then I had my double mastectomy and all of a sudden I'm like, oh, my boobs aren't going to get in the way of me running anymore. So why don't I start doing the Cash to 5K? And hey, that's not the positive I expected to take out of this experience, but
there's, you know, one positive there.
Yeah, like I just think choosing your mood is huge, because I just think the way that you see the world dictates how it kind of you receive it.
And lastly, Erin, we like to ask all our guests on the Monday Mile podcast what their relationship is like with Monday, the start of the week.
I love Mondays. I'm a get up and go sort of gal. I'm proper positive about Mondays. I think it's partly my husband, Sam. He's in the army, went to Sandhurst, and he always used to get the Sunday scaries before going back to Sandhurst on the Monday. So I think almost reactionary, I've become uber positive about Mondays. And now he really likes going to work. He's still in the army. But I think the positivity about Monday stayed.
Strong. I like it. Erin Kennedy, thank you so much for joining us here on the Monday Mile Walk and Talk podcast. If you are new to the podcast, the audio drops every single Monday morning at 12 a.m. for the early risers. We are also now on YouTube. So if you are watching us on YouTube, make sure you give us a like and a subscribe. And Erin, we are wishing you so much luck on your journey to Paris. It's quite literally just around the corner. And regardless, what a celebration to have after the most turbulent 3 years of your life. Put it up. You rock. What an inspiration.
Thank you.
It's a wrap. Woo!